How are you doing? Mostly we're good, I think. My name's Matt, if we haven't met. Lovely to have you here. We're spending about 6 weeks as a church on Sundays looking at the New Testament book known as 2 Peter, written by this guy Peter, who knew Jesus very closely and then a number of years later wrote a letter about what it meant to follow him in practice. And as we are at this point in the series, we're heading into the middle of it, but I want to prepare you for today. Here is a simple structure of this book, okay? It's three chapters. Chapter 1 is like warm, nice, pastoral stuff about God and following him. And chapter 3 is warm, nice, pastoral stuff about God and following him. And in the middle, chapter 2 is intense and challenging and strange and quite hard to get your head around. I would guess it's nobody in the world's favourite chapter of the Bible. That would be my guess. Okay, guess which chapter we're doing this evening. Have a guess. That's right, it's number 2. And just to say, we're doing it all at once because it is all one unified message. And if you're visiting us today, you're here for the first time, or you've not been to church very much, you might, when we get into this, you might think, what the heck is this? What is this? Let me just say, as a church, we are committed to engaging with everything the Bible says. We don't want to skip the bits that we find more difficult. And in fact, for all the strangeness of this passage, I hope it becomes clear that what sits underneath these words is a God of love who deeply cares about each of us, including you personally, and who, like a great parent, will sometimes say tricky things for our own good. So I'm going to read the whole thing out to you. It will also be on the screen. Then break it down into some manageable thoughts, okay? Just to set the context, Peter's writing in the first century to other Christians. That's important to know. It's written to other Christians. He's just mentioned in the previous bit how God has revealed himself to humanity, and that's this amazing thing. And then he says this, so make sure you are sitting comfortably, okay? But there were also false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. They will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the sovereign Lord who bought them, bringing swift destruction on themselves. Many will follow their depraved conduct and will bring the way of truth into disrepute. In their greed, these teachers will exploit you with fabricated stories. Their condemnation has long been hanging over them, and their destruction has not been sleeping. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood and its ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and 7 others, if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes and made them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly, and if he rescued Lot, a righteous man who was distressed by the depraved conduct of the lawless, for that righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard. If this is so, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to hold the unrighteous for punishment on the day of judgment. This is especially true of those who follow the corrupt desire of the flesh and despise authority. Bold and arrogant, they are not afraid to heap abuse on celestial beings, yet even angels, although they are stronger and more powerful, do not heap abuse on such beings when bringing judgment on them from the Lord. But these people blaspheme in matters they do not understand. They are like unreasoning animals, creatures of instinct, born only to be caught and destroyed, and like animals they too will perish. They will be paid back from harm for the harm they have done. Their idea of pleasure is to carouse in broad daylight. They are blots and blemishes, reveling in their pleasures while they feast with you. With eyes full of adultery, they never stop sinning. They seduce the unstable. They are experts in greed, an accursed brood. They have left the straight way and wandered off to follow the way of Balaam, son of Beor, who loved the wages of wickedness. But he was rebuked for his wrongdoing by a donkey, an animal without speech, who spoke with a human voice and restrained the prophet's madness. These people are springs without water and mists driven by a storm. Blackest darkness is reserved for them, for they mouth empty, boastful words, and by appealing to the lustful desires of the flesh, they entice people who are just escaping from those who live in error. They promise them freedom while they themselves are slaves of depravity, for people are slaves to whatever has mastered them. If they have escaped the corruption of the world by knowing our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ and are again entangled in it and are overcome. They are worse off at the end than they were at the beginning. It would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than to have known it and then to turn their backs on the sacred command that was passed to them. Of them, the proverbs are true. A dog returns to its vomit, and a sow that is washed returns to her wallowing in the mud. So there we go. Welcome to Maybridge. What do we do with this? Well, firstly, let's wind back the clock and think about the context Peter the author was living in when he wrote this. At this point, the church was brand new. In fact, it was tiny. It was maybe a few decades at the most since Jesus had taught and done miracles and then been executed and then miraculously risen again. It was amazing. Most important thing that's ever happened. And people who knew Jesus personally, like Peter, start telling everybody. And to begin with, of course, it's completely informal. It's just a message. There's no church buildings. There's no handbook to being a Christian. There's just a growing number of people who've come to believe that Jesus has risen from death and that he is this special person. And that was great. That was a great thing. But there were also, quite quickly, people who would travel around from community to community making stuff up, basically, about God or about Jesus in particular, and they would do it to get loads of attention and to make money and other things too. False teachers, they were called. And so for the average person with no printed Bible, no books at all, no mobile phones, can you imagine? And most people were illiterate anyway. How did you know what was true and what was fake news? How did you know? Well, the best source was actually people like Peter, people who had spent a lot of time with Jesus personally, followed him for a long time, and is therefore very qualified to cut through the nonsense and tell everybody the real story. Everything that Peter says across this letter we're walking through is at root based on how much God loves us. And in this strange passage today, I want to draw out three things. God spotlights false teaching, God condemns false teaching, and God judges false teaching. It all sounds very serious, doesn't it? Well, it is. But it's because he loves us. And he wants us to know and live in what's true and not what's false. So let's see how it plays out. As I said, a few manageable points. That first one, God spotlights false teaching. We live in a time that generally says, believe whatever feels good to you. Which, guess what? Feels good. And so although we all like to think that we are rational people who only commit to things with good reason, in fact, it's been well documented that people form their beliefs about anything far more because of their emotional needs and what people around them say than anything else. Which is not entirely bad. Our emotions tell us something and other people bring us wisdom that we don't have. But of course, popular opinion, or how we feel on the day, is not the gold standard of what's true, is it? It's not the gold standard. Look at how Peter starts this. He looks back into history and at his present day and says, there were false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you. In other words, this is not a new thing. There have always been people who say stuff that's not true and do so for bad reasons. I don't know about you, but I find that a bit scary. Now, who are these people? If these false teachers showed up at church in big cars with gold suits and Rolexes and asked us for money, we'd probably say, well, hold on, this does not seem legit to me. But they don't. They look like everybody else. But slowly and perhaps secretly, they introduce new ideas. Probably not aggressive. And this is not just about innocently, you know, somebody who asks questions. This is someone who just chips away at things and over time influences people to believe things that just move them away from Jesus. Even denying him, Peter says. And this is done to exploit people to get their money or their praise or whatever. The Greek wording where Peter says fabricated stories means something like polished rhetoric designed to deceive. The root word is the same one from which we get the word plastic. They sound good. Great communication skills. Slick presentations. And as he notes, unfortunately, a lot of people will get drawn in by this. These days, there are more ways than ever to get both good, solid, thoughtful, teaching about Jesus based on humble research and to find absolute garbage that sounds good. There's this thing called the internet. Have you come across this? And it's home to both of those things. You can hear more people talk about more things than you ever could in history a million times over. There's so much of it. So how do you know what to believe? Or how do you know who is speaking truth? We'll come back to that. The other thing to draw out from this little section is there are consequences for people who teach for their own gain. They bring destruction on themselves. Their condemnation is hanging over them. Do you see what's happening? God is spotlighting false teaching through Peter's words. He's saying it exists and it's a problem, but he's not blind to it. He loves us in a thousand ways, and one of those ways is a concern that we take hold of what's true and know how to reject what's false. Because bad ideas ultimately damage people. The late great 20th century philosopher Francis Schaeffer said this: you can't live with the results of untrue ideas forever. You can't live with the results of untrue ideas forever. They get people in a mess. And that's why God gets involved. Which leads to the second big point I've got on this. God condemns false teaching. Peter forms his understanding of this issue by looking at what happened in the past. He goes over history and he thinks of different times when God enacts judgment on people. He's got quite a lot of material going over these different stories. But in brief, Peter remembers that even angels, beings created to be servants and representatives of God, face judgment when they reject God. He remembers the story of Noah and how in his time the world became so messy, so dark, that God flooded it and began again, but protected Noah and his group. And he remembers a similar story of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, which rejected God wildly in awful ways for hundreds of years, but God protected a man called Lot who followed him. And Peter's point is, God can at the same time deal with those who stand against him and damage the world, and protect and care for people who live in the same time and space moment. He's done it before. We might be tricked or confused about false teachers and ulterior motives, but God is not. He knows exactly what's going on, and he will enact justice in his time. Again, Peter's not talking about people who slipped up or made a mistake or misspoke. He's talking about those who deliberately set themselves up almost as little gods, who may use nice words but actually just live for themselves. But God's people will be kept safe. Peter continues. He gets a bit more specific about what false teachers do. And so this starts getting into how to spot them, which is helpful. He throws in reference to the story of Balaam. Don't know if you know his story. In the Old Testament, he advises Israel's enemies, the Midianites, to try and entice the people of Israel away from God with sexual temptations, and he gets them to worship false gods and idols. And this man, Balaam, is motivated by money. That's why he's doing it. And in the same way, Peter says, you can spot these guys by how they live. They do things like carouse in broad daylight. They're adulterous. They're greedy for money. And they say what brings in cash rather than what's true. The draw of things like sex and money will always be there, of course. But there are other reasons why false teachers will seek to exploit people. Attention, influence, getting some sort of validation, controlling people. And what Peter is saying through this, I think, is a helpful principle. Pay attention to what someone stands to gain from you agreeing with what they're saying. What do they stand to get from it? That will tell you a lot. What will they get from your agreement or support? Again, the underlying thing is the love of God. God condemns all this because he's not passive and indifferent. If someone was teaching my children or yours things that were untrue and damaging, we'd want to put a stop to it, wouldn't we? And God's the same. That's why in the final section we see that he judges false teaching. The way this is written seems probably very extreme to our polite English sensibility. But Peter is Jewish, for one, but also he doesn't subscribe to that modern idea of believing what feels right to you. He is convinced that moving away from Jesus, who he knew personally, remember, is a disaster on every level for your life. So this is all in very strong terms. Note in the passage, Peter consistently connects belief and behavior. You can't separate how you behave from what you really at heart believe. And that's why false teaching is, it's not just somebody having a few bad theological ideas. Like a river flowing downstream, it produces immorality, arrogance, greed, exploitation. Whereas a true knowledge of Jesus leads to the opposite. Peter calls false teachers waterless springs and mists driven by a storm. What they say is empty and hollow. Maybe it sounds good. It might even say exactly what you want to hear, but it's empty. They may even use Christian ideas and words like freedom, but redefine them to tell you that doing whatever you like has got to be the best way to live. He uses two proverbs to illustrate this. A dog returns to its vomit, and a sow that is washed returns to her wallowing in the mud. In both cases, a dog or a pig can be outwardly cleaned up, but its inner nature will be the same. Dogs will still pick through their vomit. Pigs will get muddy again. In the same way, if the heart is not changed, the individual will always return to the same old patterns. And that's the thing with false teaching. Because it's empty, it does nothing to change the heart. Nothing. And again, and we talk about this quite a lot at Maybridge, I think, God is not after some lifestyle adjustments or some superficial behavior changes in each of us. This is the great irony. False teaching promises freedom. It says nice things to you. It says God's ways are wrong, basically. Wouldn't phrase it like that, but that's what gets said. It says there's a better alternative, but it's a pale imitation of the real thing. False teaching is actually, would you believe, a type of legalism. It's a type of legalism. It turns the good news of Jesus into something that is about you and your attempts to live your best life. It will tell you what you like to hear in the moment, but in the end, it is death coated in sugar. And that's why, in his love, God spotlights it, condemns it, and always finally judges it. So what do we do with this? You still with me? This is heavy, isn't it, this passage? What do we do? Because most of our experience probably doesn't ring quite naturally with what we're reading in this text. Let's get practical. What do we do with an intense passage like this? I've got some thoughts that I think this passage points us to without necessarily saying it explicitly, but it moves us in that direction. First one, think and pray carefully about the sources that you go to. There are loads of things out there, aren't there? Books, podcasts, YouTube clips, TikTok videos, but I'm too old to watch those, more than ever before. How do you know what's good and what's not? How do you know? Where would you even begin? Well, I came up with what I think are some helpful questions to ask yourself about anybody who sets themselves up to teach others, including, I should say, me or anybody else who does this at Maybridge. Okay, don't just because I'm saying it, don't assume that it's true. I mean, I hope it is, but don't assume that it is. And any place you hear somebody teach about God, these are helpful questions to ask, okay? So the first one, is what they are teaching focused primarily on Jesus or on something else? The Bible touches on a lot of stuff. It's really long. It touches on loads of subjects, touches on the meaning of life and what life looks like, loads of stuff. So in a sense, you know, it's great to talk about all sorts of different subjects. But what's the main message? Is the main message this person is communicating to you about personal achievement or getting healed or having more knowledge? Or is it shining a light on Jesus? If it doesn't, avoid. If it's not about Jesus, it's just lifestyle coaching or speculation. Does what they're teaching reflect the overall picture of the Bible? It's very easy, we've probably all heard this at some point, it's very easy to take one verse out of context and make it say something it doesn't. In fact, I think you can take one verse out of the Bible on its own and pretty much make it say anything without context. Good teaching will be mindful of the whole message of the Bible, again, Jesus being at the heart of it. Does the person saying this stand to gain anything from my agreement? Is there anything they personally will get if I go along with what they're saying? Is it money, attention, more followers, whatever? The economist Thomas Sowell says this, When you want to help people, you tell them the truth. When you want to help yourself, you tell them what they want to hear. I think he's right on that one, isn't he? Related to that, is what they are teaching simply what I want to be true? This is a significant challenge because, of course, everybody gravitates towards what they want to hear, don't they? Of course we do. But that's not wise. In the same way, when you go to the doctor, you don't want your doctor to tell you what you want to hear. You want your doctor to tell you what the truth is as best as they possibly can. That's the best way to help you. Is what they are teaching an unusual or minority position on the subject, and why? Be wise enough to be skeptical about new theological ideas. If something was invented, I'm talking about theology here, I'm not talking about like cars and stuff. If something was invented recently and claims to be some great insight that nobody noticed for 2,000 years, it's probably not true. Probably. If it's something that almost nobody in the history of the global church has believed until the last 5 minutes, it's probably not true. If you take away the teacher's popularity, eloquence, or charisma, what remains? We all know those traits are powerful, but they can be incredibly hollow. Does the actual content of what somebody says still stand up if you take away fine words and a big personality? How many different sources do I rely on when it comes to learning about God? If you go to one person for everything, even if they're a really good teacher, that's not a great idea. You know when someone's like, oh, I found this guy on YouTube and I've listened to all of his talks for the last 45 years. I've done nothing else for the last month. I'm a bit like, really? Be open to hearing different people from different backgrounds, but make sure it's lots of different people or multiple different people who follow Jesus and back it up with good character. Final question. If you asked a trusted friend who is a different personality or temperament to you, what would they say about this? Other people have wisdom that we don't and may well spot problems that we wouldn't. Don't be isolated. That's dangerous. Draw on the wisdom that God puts around you when you're trying to discern if something is helpful and it's good or not. Second big point, though. Do sensible things over time that will help you differentiate truth from false teaching. These days, it's pretty easy to get a personal Bible, even to get one on your phone, and that's a great thing. But sometimes that can make us very individualistic. The Bible historically was always meant to be read and understood in community. For a lot of history, people didn't even have their own one, and most people couldn't read anyway. Wrestling with it in community, for example, in a partnership group, helps us stay on track. It stops us building or, you know, going off on our own wacky ideas. And also, and I'm aware of how it looks for it to be me that says this, but being part of church on a Sunday, hearing the Bible taught by hopefully someone who has done some homework and has some level of expertise is also a way that God keeps us on track and speaks truth to us. And also, pursue a faith that has depth and can cope with the complexities of life and handle suffering. False teaching, because it's hollow, tends to be of very little help when real life hits. An authentic, deep faith will challenge you, it will help you deal with suffering, it may make your life more complicated in some ways, but it will in the end be richer and more joyful. Third, be aware of what is primary and what is secondary. Christians, like everybody else, will see things imperfectly because we're all limited, we're all imperfect. None of us has got a monopoly on understanding truth. God does, we don't. I really like the humility of a guy called N.T. Wright. If you've heard of him, he's a very globally famous Bible scholar, super intelligent, well, very unbelievably well read. And he once said, at least a third of what I teach is wrong. I just don't know which third. And I thought that was a very humble thing to say. Our trust is not in ourselves or any expert. Experts are helpful, but at root, our trust is in God. And within that, it's really helpful to be able to separate what's primary and what's secondary, what we as a church should not compromise on, and where we can live with disagreeing. So, for example, it's primary for Christians throughout history to believe that Jesus is God, and only through him do we ultimately get made right with God. And on the other hand, Christians have disagreed about things like charismatic gifts or baptizing children and many other things. That's not because there's not a right answer. There will be a right answer, whatever God thinks is the right answer. It's because our limited brains will get stuff wrong, and we're influenced by all sorts of different things that affect how we view different ideas. False teaching is not anything that you happen personally to disagree with. Okay? It's mad that we need to say that, but we do. Just because you disagree, it doesn't mean that it's wrong. You might be wrong. Shock horror. So this is not, you know, when someone misspeaks or innocently asks questions, we don't need to be pernickety or harsh and go, oh, yeah, false teacher, because they said the wrong thing there. No. Don't need to do any of that. But most importantly, my final thing on this, have confidence in God, not in your ability to understand him. Have confidence in God, not in your ability to understand him. Having been a Christian myself for quite a long time, I find I'm both more convinced that the Bible is the true story of Jesus and God's relationship with us, but also more and more disheartened at how bad a job people can do of teaching it and interpreting it properly. There's stuff we can do that's helpful. We've touched on some of that. But let's not have confidence at the end of the day in ourselves or the people that we might look to for insight. None of us is discerning enough to fully judge true and false. But God is. God is, and he's active. He'll put false teaching in the spotlight. He condemns it. He judges it. Do we have a confidence in him above our ability to understand him? Because they're not the same thing. Jesus once had a conversation with somebody who was seeking truth. And he said, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really know me, you will know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Because the truth is a person, the pressure is not on us to have all the knowledge and have all the right answers. It's to know the person. Jesus doesn't just have the truth. He is the truth. That's what he says about himself. No, nobody else in history ever said this. Everybody else in history, loads of people have said, I've got the truth. Nobody says, I am the truth, except him, which is incredible. So rely on him, not your own brain, however big or small it may be. And just as I close, if this has all been a bit heavy, and you maybe feel like it's over your head in a few ways, the simplest thing is this. Keep it about Jesus. And if you're here exploring at the moment, you're not sure about all this, that's what we want to get across. And hopefully that is what we are getting across today, that we are all, each of us, a bit of a mess. We all get it wrong. But we want to share and talk about him, because actually he's where the answers lie. He's where the truth really is. So I'm going to hand back over to Josh, but please do stand and let's worship together.